This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, you're with Extra with me, Geraldine Doogue, bringing you just some of the people and the stories that excite me each week. So great to have your company for the next half hour. This morning, as we all grapple with that sense of living in massively changing times, we assess one key trend's impacts on habits and attitudes, the Me Too movement and its influence on Australia. It's 1 year old this month. Will its impact be durable? Or is it more of a shooting star? Channeling anger, yes, at some powerful men's behaviour, but not really shifting codes long term. Here's Michelle Obama being questioned on the Today Show on the US CBS network.
There are some who believe that the Me Too movement went to a point, and some say there's a backlash that's happening, that now men are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, what about us? Your thoughts on that.
Well, that's what happens with change. You know, the change is not a direct, smooth path. There's going to be bumps and resistance. I mean, there has been a status quo in terms of the way women have been treated, what their expectations have been in this society, and that is changing. And there's going to be a little upheaval. There's going to be a little discomfort. But I think it's up to the women out there to say, sorry. Sorry that you feel uncomfortable, but I'm now paving the way for the next generation.
Now, at The Economist magazine, noting this first anniversary, suggested that the Me Too movement could be the most powerful force for equality since women's suffrage at the start of the 20th century, which is a huge claim if you think about it. And we felt we would test it because the $64,000 question rattling around many minds is what Me Too represents, really. Can it bring about long-term change? Well, I'm joined now to wrestle with this from Melbourne by Claire Wright, author of Daughters of Freedom, The Australians Who Won the Vote and Inspired the World. In other words, someone who really does know about the suffragettes. And Susan Ryan, former minister, was Labor's very first female minister and cabinet member, serving initially in the portfolio of Education and Youth Affairs, also the inaugural minister assisting the Prime Minister on the status of women, and instrumental in passing the landmark Sex Discrimination Act in 1984, something she describes as probably the most useful thing I've done in my life. So welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Hi, Geraldine.
I wonder what you both do feel about bumps along the way, as Michelle Obama just talked about then, whether that's what we're going through or whether we are living through something as powerful as the women's suffrage movement that The Economist suggests. Claire, what do you think?
Well, I think it's way too early to tell whether there's going to be any equivalence between the global movement for women's suffrage that started as early as the 1840s. And in some countries around the world, we're only just seeing the fruits of that. You know, it's really extraordinary to think that in countries like France, women didn't get the vote until 1945, in Switzerland, not till 1975. So, you know, it's not ancient history. This was decades and decades and decades of struggle. And there weren't bumps along the road. There were mountains in the way of those women who were around the world struggling for those very basic democratic and human rights. So I think that there's, you know, an enormous amount of focus on the Me Too movement, and I think that it has been in particular a huge media moment, and it's fascinating, and I definitely think it's made men uncomfortable, but I think it's way too early to tell whether it's going to have any long-term structural change as well as behavioural change.
Susan, your thoughts?
Well, the potential for real change, a real resetting of the relationships between men and women around the world is there, and it's there because of the global nature of it. And this is, you know, one of the good things about social media. It started in Hollywood and it's now a global movement. India's got a Me Too movement and so on. So I think the potential is there. But what I get very concerned about is what happens next. Yes, the women name and shame the perpetrators, and that is a positive thing, and already some male heads have rolled and some careers have been destroyed because they've been exposed. Women have gained confidence, and a very good thing, Geraldine, is that I think women are finding again the power of collective action, which is what the suffragettes had, which is what we second wave feminists, you know, the 70s feminists, we had a great commitment to collective action. So that's all good, but I would also say we need to get the institutions that can change to put those changes into law and into policy. I'm seeing a bit of that happening in Australia, but I want to see a lot more now. Strike while the iron of Me Too is hot.
The specifics, what struck me, Susan and Claire, is that in a sense, as you make the point, Claire, in your recent work, there was a specific thing the suffragettes were asking for, the vote. And it had all sorts of implications, but there was something very specific about it. This is much more diffuse, isn't it, Susan?
It is more diffuse because, I mean, the specific thing that I think we should be focusing on is the right of women, or anyone, but women we're talking about generally, to pursue their jobs, their careers, without being subjected to sexual harassment and abuse. Now, that's a specific thing, but then how you implement it within universities, within media organisations, within big corporations, within small businesses, I mean, how you implement it and make it real is, I think, a lot more diffuse than saying, well, okay, you turn up, the Wentworth, one of the polling booths this morning, you're on the list, you get to vote. Yes, it is more diffuse, but I think the potential is there to harness all of this outrage and expression of disgust at conventional male practices in workplaces and so on. But we have to do things and we have to do them now.
But, you know, when you were devising that Sex Discrimination Act, there, as I recall, tell me if I'm wrong at any point, it was very clear there were definitions for sexual harassment. It had to be repeated, unwanted, and have the ability to affect your standing at work.
So that's right.
So, and I can remember reporting on things which didn't quite conform to those definitions. And one of the accusations I would suggest that is being made now about the Me Too, one of the unpleasant things of the Me Too movement, is that people, men in particular, are being shamed for things that haven't come before a court. And there's a sort of community shaming and a community judgment that has never been properly tested, and they can't emerge from it.
Look, that is a problem, and I think in the new processes that I'm advocating, new laws, new internal processes in organisations, the principle of fairness has to be firmly embedded, because a man's career or reputation or family life can be ruined by an accusation which is untrue. Now, and that can happen. We know it can happen. Most of the accusations, I think, are founded in things that happened. But we really have to make sure that the processes, and this is why it does get very complicated, the processes in place are fair to both parties. And employers have to become much more aware and informed and focus much more on how do we protect people against sexual abuse in the workplace? What are the processes? Does everyone know about them? Are they fair? Can we be sure that there will be no punishment of a person who brings a complaint that is a complaint? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there has to be some confidentiality and privacy. All of these things have to be embedded in the new way we handle all of these things.
And I mean, Claire, how does this compare and contrast with what was happening to the suffragettes when there was a great deal of discussion about defending democracy, you tell me in your book, which is, I think, a very different discussion to this one that Susan's just described?
Well, they were talking about basic political rights that women didn't even have at the time. It was about the ability to have a voice as part of a civic body, as citizenship, to be treated as adult citizens. And I think the kind of voice that we're talking about now is quite different. It's about the ability to speak for oneself, to speak out, to speak up, and to speak one's own truth. And on some levels, there's an equivalence in terms of, you know, it's basically the idea of getting to set the terms. Who gets to set the terms? Who gets to say what's fair? Who gets to say what's just?
Mm.
And I think what's really interesting in this conversation is that it, in terms of what Susan was just saying, is that there are resonances from the suffragette movement in terms of the two very different strands of campaign tactics. So there had been the constitutionalists who had for decades through the 19th century said, well, we are going to fight for women's rights to vote, but we will do it through completely constitutional means, which means petitioning Parliament, lobbying, and keeping strictly within the limits of the law, of the rule of law. And then around 1904, Emmeline Pankhurst's organisation comes along and says, nah, we've gotten nowhere. We've been doing that for decades. We've gotten nowhere. We've got to up the ante. We've got to show them that we really mean business. And we've got to take on the hypocrisy that they're asking us to stay within the law, and yet we're not recognised within the law. And they use those very democratic principles. No taxation without representation. So we don't have representation. Gosh. Hey, you know what? We're not going to pay our taxes. And so there was a whole movement that started, not just the window smashing and some of the more violent aspects of militantism that we saw in later years, but earlier there were campaigns, very orchestrated, highly orchestrated campaigns of civil disobedience. In 1911, the Women of Britain, actually it was an Australian woman's idea to do this, was to have a census resistance, just not fill out the census on census night. Because if they're not counted as citizens, well, why count us as part of your bureaucratic exercise? And there were some people that said at the time, well, this is just unruly. Women are acting outside the law. And yet they said, we're not included in the law in the first place. So which do you want? So I think in some ways in the Me Too movement, it's about how far people want to push the barrow tactically. And I think this is one of the problems with the movement is at the moment is that I don't think there is a sense of an orchestrated, organised campaign. I agree with Susan that there are glimmerings of collective action and that women are being drawn to the movement. But it's difficult to see where the movement is going because I don't think there is a sense of leadership or necessarily of agreed set of tactics or even two different camps that people can fall in and peg their colours to the mask. And when I say the colours, I mean that quite literally, that these different women's suffrage organisations wore different colours. They branded themselves in different colours that symbolised different things. So you could see which camp people fell in.
On RN, you're listening to Extra, the best of Saturday's show, with me, Geraldine Duke.
Yes, my guests are Susan Ryan, former Labor minister, and Claire, and a range of other things too, like Age Discrimination Commissioner most recently, and Claire Wright, an author most recently of You Daughters of Freedom, the Australians Who Won the Vote and Inspired the World. So, Susan, there's another concern of Me Too from, say, the philosopher Slavoj Žižek, who's concerned that it runs the risk of turning victimhood into a form of empowerment where political legitimisation is based on a person's victimhood status. And he doesn't think this is entirely healthy. Now, do you agree?
Well, I can certainly respond to what he's saying, because it worries me too that in all of the efforts and changes we thought we put in place a generation ago, where women have power over their own lives, they have choice, they have economic options, they have work choices, to reduce all that to, if I'm harassed in the workplace, that all falls over. And the people we most want to hear from are the people who have not been able to stand up to harassment. I think that is a danger. And I think it's extremely important in all of the various strategies. And I have to say to Claire, I don't think we'll have one strategy. I think we'll have all sorts of strategies. One of the strategies has to be to revisit the way we educate young women from school onwards to say, you don't have to put up with these things. You can take power. You can say, I'm not putting up with that. I'm going to complain about this immediately. And to do that effectively, I think we need the examples of the women who have been able to achieve all kinds of things in their working lives, their careers and so forth, even in, you know, shark-infested waters, because they had the self-confidence to say, no, I'm not putting up with that. I think one of the very things that I was most distressed about when the Me Too movement began with the Hollywood actresses and so on was the a repeated claim that many of them made, and I'm sure they meant it sincerely, that they had to tolerate it because otherwise they would not have got the job they're after.
Well, I mean, that's classic. That classically contradicts those terms that you set for the Sex Discrimination Act.
Yes, that's right. And so the idea that any job is worth putting up with, gross sexual assault, that idea has to go. And look, if you miss out on one role...
So you mean you step back. If it's too obnoxious, you step out.
Don't do it. Don't do it. And look, again, there are women who've had very successful careers in theatre and TV and film and so on, who it would appear managed all that. I was reminded of that wonderful doco film that came out quite recently called Tea with the Dames, Dench and Maggie Smith and so on. And they were just talking, the women in their 80s, talking about their lives that they had in some ways in very inauspicious circumstances. And look, they're still going strong. They're still getting cast in important roles. And, I hope young actresses look at them and think, well, look, there they are in their 80s, still appearing in best top hit movies and TV shows. They did something right. Yeah, we don't have to put up with this intolerable treatment.
No, and I mean, people like Nicole Kidman came out this week saying she was... But really, she was protected by being married to Tom Cruise. These are two of the biggest stars in the world. What about people way down the list who don't have anything like that sort of leverage?
What about women who were working in factories and being sexually harassed by their bosses? I think that the focus on these top-end and more glamorous industries in some ways obscures the picture of what's going on all over the place.
I just want to come back to something because we've only got a few more minutes.
Yes.
But one of the things, Claire, that you make the point, and I think, because I think we should be talking about men as well, that women's suffrage was one of the key factors, you say, in creating feelings of national belonging, a sense of pride in and belonging to a place that was uniquely innovative, bold and progressive. This was Australia because it started in New Zealand and then went to South Australia and Australia. It's really should be a source of great pride. So what about almost, like, do you sense that men now, who were worried then about women getting the vote because they didn't know where it would lead, do you sense that men now are looking on saying, my gosh, this is going to change everything that we take for granted, or not? Would they like to work in a place where women were treated much better?
Well, men are absolutely key to this, and I'm really glad that you've raised the point, because men were both the problem and also the solution in the suffrage movement, and that was for the very specific reason that there couldn't be any change to any of the laws without men instituting them, because they were the exclusive lawmakers. So women couldn't get the vote without a man introducing a suffrage bill into Parliament. And Vida Goldstein, who was the leader of the Australian suffrage movement, did say that the reason that Australia won these historic rights before any other nation in the world, and New Zealand had the right to vote, but Australia had the right to vote and to stand for Parliament, and that the reason why Australia was world-leading in democratic practice was the willingness of Australian men to get behind the justice needs of its women. And I think that, we have that expression these days, male champions of change, and there are some organised bodies around that idea. Well, there have always been male champions of change, and there have needed to be, and there still need to be, So there are men that need to respond, not worrying about losing their power or their privilege or their position, but actually saying, well, this is right and fair and good, and this is part of the society that I want to live in. And yes, I will be prouder to live in a country that places justice at the centre of its civil contracts, in the way that Australia was very proud at the turn of the century for putting justice at the centre of its constitution in terms of gender equality, not racial equality, of course. That would come later.
But
gender equality.
Let me just give Susan the final word. I see that Australia's Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins, has unveiled a national inquiry into workplace sexual harassment to look at solutions. That was announced in June this year, though clearly it did. The Harvey Weinstein thing did help. And they run regular surveys. They've asked people to get in contact with them. They show an increase in their latest results from 20% in 2012 to 39% of women and 26% of men, I notice, reporting they've been sexually harassed at work in the last 5 years. Now, do you see improvement, Susan Ryan?
I see the possibility of improvement, and I'm very pleased that the Sex Discrimination Commissioner is doing this national inquiry, because it will enable people to focus on what can happen to change. Now, the Hawke government and me put the first sexual harassment provisions into the 1984 Act. It is certainly time to look at how they can be redefined, strengthened, and that the right processes could be put in place. Women do take advantage of those protections still, you know. I mean, if you look at the number of complaints that come to the Human Rights Commission about sex discrimination in the workplace, and a high number of those are satisfactorily resolved. It's just that many, many more women aren't even aware of it and don't take it. But look, I am hopeful that this national inquiry will give us the directions of change, and I believe we will have in the Parliament, enough parliamentarians willing to vote for stronger and more effective measures. And I think we can see a way forward. But we have to be ever vigilant, and it's always a work in progress.
And I'm going to ask you another final question, because one of the other comments, like Maureen Dowd, the New York Times writer, has talked about Me Too needing a path towards, actually it's The Economist who said this, a path towards atonement or absolution. In other words, let's say a man does admit that he has behaved badly in the past, but he doesn't intend to in the future. Is he allowed back? Because that's another issue that is emerging. Are people sort of sent to the stocks forever and ever?
Oh, look, I think that comes down to how the individual behaves. I really think an enlightened society, we should recognise that people make mistakes and recognise them and get over them. On the other hand, sometimes you might think that they're being forgiven a little bit too quickly. And, I don't want to be party political here, but I think that if... It's a question of fairness, but certainly in relation to the workplace. Now, I want to come back to this. The sexual harassment provisions are all about making sure that women can go out and make a living, whether they're actresses, whether they're working in factories or shops or in the media. They need to be able to pursue economic independence in their chosen area of work without harassment. Now, if there's ongoing harassment, I don't think forgiveness is called for. If there's a case, it's dealt with, everyone says, yes, that shouldn't happen and it won't happen again, okay, forgiveness is fine under those circumstances. But I think a lot more awareness by some of the perpetrators would be required before, atonement and forgiveness can be the order of the day.
Yes. Okay. Very interesting. And I do welcome thoughts, because it is very much a work in progress, this. And I thank you both very much indeed. Susan Ryan, thank you to you.
Thank you, Geraldine.
And Claire is the author of You Daughters of Freedom, The Australians Who Won the Vote and Inspired the World. It's a text publication. Thank you to you.
Thanks very much, Geraldine.
I'm Geraldine Doogue. I do hope you can join me at the same time next week, or online via the RN website.